Yes, Ansa, thank you very much for the invitation, and of course, Pascu Evara also for keeping things up and going. And thank you all for joining us for this conference. So I think I start with a joke first to warm up, because when Jacques Derrida was asked in the 1980s sometimes to join a conference in California about the state of theory, then he started with the first sentence, well, the state of theory, what is it? Isn't it Southern California? So I'd rather start like that too and say, the architecture of the Canaan, well, isn't that the Haus der Kultur in der Welt anyway? So, and exactly this Berlin saying, going back to the natives of Berlin, calling this building the Schwangere Auster, the pregnant oyster, I think it's very apt, it's very pregnant, of course, as a saying about what the architecture of the Canaan is in 1950s modernism and their concept of what modernism is. So I think we couldn't go any further. I'll explain, of course, with my talk. And as the zero point, it's not really a zero point because we have to go back to antiquities large and far, but at least they are turning points. And of course, I can start from scratch somehow. And that's, of course, the only chance I have, and we all have. We have to go back to the beginnings, the original sin, or to the original innocence. So I'll do it in four steps. Talking about four concepts of the Canaan. The technical Canaan, with a fictitious dating of 1700. The aesthetic Canaan, which has never left us ever since 1800. The avant-gardistic quest for a new Canaan around 1900. And the problematic Canaan, which is the pregnant oyster and its sequels. And all I have to say are slogans. You know, media theorists are used to use slogans like Marshall McLuhan. And all I have to say is really then in what I read and just reread. So starting with the technical Canaan and going back to the ancient system of the arts. You know, the modern system of the arts only developed in the 18th century, and before that, art didn't really exist as a term, though the word art, of course, goes back to ars and Greek techne. And it was just a skill and a knowledge of practical rules, canons, and training. And the arts that we know, some of them at least were for elitist skills, and that means for artes liberales, for free people. And free people, of course, were an elite. There were not so many free people around, and probably there are not so many free people around nowadays. But so it was an elitist skill and knowledge. And the visual arts, of course, were not treated so highly, so they were artisan arts. So the artistic arts were not categorically distinguished from artisan and mechanical arts. All of it was skill or techne or ars. And in the Renaissance, from the Renaissance onwards to the modern system of the arts, basically rhetoric, which means verbal arts, were or was the dominant meta art between 1450 and 1750, also for music and the fine arts. So as a theory of art, basically or a practical theory, then rhetoric was dominant, which also means the dominance of the verbal canon. And the technical canon was meant to reproduce an ancient past and make it available for future use. So if we distinguish with Jan Assmann between the canon, the repertoire, and the archive, I have to say at least basically that this distinction was not really existent before modernity. So because the canon, the repertoire, and the archive were basically at least not the same, but in transitional phases. Antiquity, which means of course Greek and Roman antiquity, but also other antiquities, were a repertoire. So a repertoire you can choose from to perform something new. Were the canon, so which is the model or the canonical models, and the archive. But there were specialists developing antiquities between the 15th century and the 18th or even the 19th century, from the Florence humanism to, let's say, people like Abi Warburg, basically, and they were called antiquarians later. And antiquarianism was the collection and reconstruction of the archive of antiquity, and as we can call it, the primeval soup of all later historical disciplines which didn't exist at that time. Medieval history, numismatics, history proper in a sense too. Antiquarianism developed from what we could call a cosmopolitanism in reverse, which means it was related to an empire and a civilization that didn't exist anymore, the Roman Empire, and the models, the Greek models of the Roman Empire, but the Hellenistic period in general too. And thus, if we quote this famous Chakrabarti book, we can say that it was provincializing Europe, because all the provinces of the Roman Empire had to turn inside out to reconstruct their past, like Gallic, Gauls, Germanic, German, or even Gothic, Sweden, past along these terms of the old, long-gone empire. So by tracing the fragments of an aesthetically superior civilization and empire. So which comes to the question, how Eurocentric was this canon of antiquity, of antiquities? It's a very crucial question, because we have to think, we have to retrace the whole post-colonial question to this early period of early modernism, and especially also because of Orientalism. Because there was an Orient before Orientalism, and Orient was the territories of the Bible, which means for Christians, and not only for Christians, of course, it was a center out there, means centered around Jerusalem, as in the Crusades and other encounters. So Europe, in a sense, didn't exist, first of all. Western Europe didn't exist either. And the center of the world was a center out there for pilgrimage, or also for imagination, and for centering the world, especially because there was no original language, because Latin was not the original language of the sacred writings. So within the short biblical chronology, pagan antiquity, after the Columbian travels and conquests, became a worldwide stratum of antiquity in this antiquarian movement. So people working in America or about America, Africa, and Asia, they related the old antiquity of Greeks and Romans to the newfound people all over the world. People like Bernard de Sahagún, but also Lafitau in the 18th century, they wrote about the Amerindians as if they were old Romans or Greek. So there was a stratum that was universal, and because the world was so short and so young, they could relate immediately to this old antiquity all over the world. And in the age of the gunpowder empires, which is also called this early modern period, non-European empires could be acknowledged as equal or superior in certain respects, like the Osmanic Empire, equal in military terms, or superior in statecraft, as in China, but of course not in religious terms. So in a sense, not in a sense, but in a sense, in a guilty sense, of course, Eurocentrism comes from a period where Eurocentrism was not the question, and the center was definitely not in Europe, not for Europeans. Everything changed, of course, as we know, in the 18th century, and everything changed at once, and that's part of the crucial question, why? The modern systems of the arts reclassified the arts as we still know them, a source of aesthetic appreciation, and regrouping the arts as we know them now, also literature or poetry, music and fine arts together, and separating them from technology, from crafts and skills, separating them also from the scientific disciplines, and separating them from the useful crafts or Handwerk. So, of course, there's a class distinction too, and the old elites turning into new elites, making new hierarchies that ever have stayed with us, as we know, and also in our museums, in our collections. So technology museums, craft museums, and art museums are separated, and it's part of our problem. So the modern system of the arts divided the unity of technical production and reproduction, which was the basis of skill, into aesthetic reception, which is the strongest part, because it's always the majority of the population, into artistic creativity, which becomes a riddle, and into art criticism, mediating between these two, basically, riddles of reception and production. Each position unable to encompass the other two. Of course, you can say that criticism encompasses both of them, or has to mediate both, but actually it's not possible even to say what the reception is and what the production is in criticist terms. So we have these three positions, and you have to read the sentence also in reverse. So it's not like this modern system divides up these three positions, but because the three positions were divided up practically in the 18th century, in a long period, then the new system as a theory developed. Theory comes late, after 100 years of dividing up these positions. So the practical things comes first, and the theoretical conclusions, as with Kant and others, comes second, after 100 years. And now we come to this thing that the aesthetic canon develops. And the aesthetic canon turned the technical canon, what was left from the Renaissance II, into a Eurocentric canon. And the territorial antiquities that were being dug up, archaeology and classified and so on, they were turned into national territories or regional territories developed by the nation states, though not never completely. So territories being nationalized, as here, of course, with Prussia and the liberation wars of the 1800s against Napoleon, we come to the modern system and its consequences, and the big divides that somehow have been staying with us as a problem ever since. The aesthetic canon of the modern system turned secular antiquity into Eurocentric heritage. It turned the Orient, the territories of the Bible, into Orientalism, as described by Edward Said. And it turned worldwide paganism into historylessness, of people without history, of savages. There was a universalist history in the 18th century before that turn, and everything was part of history, but then people like Hegel and others said, okay, these people do not have any history, though it was better documented than any early Greek history even then. So it was by fiat or by dogma, these were the historyless people. This new canon became an institutionalist repertoire for performing aesthetic appreciation in concerts, in museums, in libraries, schools, and other places of formal training, which means the new audience, the appreciation audience of music, of arts, of reading. They decided about this new disposition of the repertoire and the canon. And of course, states did that too, and schools. But we should keep in mind that European states in the 19th century were dual. They were not only nationalist, but they were also imperialist. So all European states, from of course Spain, Portugal, but even in the end to Italy, developed a dualism of nation states and imperial ambitions. And the same applied to the institutions of canon formation, of repertoires, and of archives. Now we come to this question of reversals and symmetries nevertheless built into this new system. The new canon was only possible because of turning away from the hierarchies of antiquity and of old feudalism, and then, in a sense, that's why anti-classicism was part of the founding moment of the modern system of the arts, especially here in Germany, in Britain, and in parts of France with Rousseau. So, it allowed for the reversal of all genre hierarchies from the start, from the 1750s onwards, because it was built to say, for example, humorous writings are more important than serious or sublime writings. Documentary literature can be as important as fictitious literature. The former lower genres, like novels, are more important than any epos or poems. So there was a reversal built into this anti-classicist moment from the start in the Northwest Europe. And that's why they could also acknowledge oral literature as being superior, for example with Herder, to written literature. So acknowledging non-European arts too, verbal arts, but other arts then in the long run too. So anti-classicism develops a kind of relativism or the reversals of hierarchy from the start. And we have to see also in Berlin, here in Berlin, Relativism developed at the same time as this Hegelian totality of hierarchical holism. That is, of course, completely fascinating. And even in postcolonial writing, you find many, many books dealing with Hegel. For example, Ranajit Gua by Buck Morse with Haiti and Hegel, so addressing this totality of Hegel. But linguistic relativism, as here developed by Humboldt, Wilhelm von Humboldt, was the strongest protagonist of relativism in the long run, and sometimes and often allied with conceptions of the psychic unity of mankind. That's a tradition in modernity that is somehow the antagonist of this Hegelian moment at the same time. Now I come to the flip side, in the sense, of that problem. So, of course, Enlightenment is a universalist movement. And Enlightenment is a universalism of secularism. And that comes to a problem that that the universalism of Enlightenment world history has never died. You could always write a world history out of parts. But a practical epistemic universalism of shared experience and of shared time, really out there, in here, of a cooperative universalism, and not on asymmetrical terms, remained an exception. But it remained an exception outside religion, where, of course, you can find this shared experience and shared time, and esotericism. So, for example, in mesmerism, in spiritualism, in modern theosophy, you find this shared experience of cooperative time, cooperative movement, but, of course, not as a secular moment. But very important for modernity. So, the avant-gardistic quest for a new canon. The modern system of the arts promised artistic autonomy, the great wish of the 18th century against the feudal system, but of course was based on market forces, of new institutional patronage, on educational certifications, and on the bourgeois distinction between utilitarian and non-utilitarian values. It's been there ever since. So that's important to keep in mind. Bürgerliches Zeitalter doesn't mean utilitarian values, as Franco Moretti now has depicted it in his book, but it's about the split between utilitarian and non-utilitarian. And of course, the aesthetic side is the non-utilitarian value. If you want to rebel against this split, you have to turn into a new way of thinking. That's, I think, what the avant-garde did between 1860 and 1940. Because their analysis was, for example, find it already with Wagner, that artistic freedom, professional alienation, and social marginality are one kind or one kin. And the first two defined as non-utilitarian by the majority of the population, but the third as parasitical. So the parasitical and the non-utilitarian are basically the same, just as pariah and prince. Avant-garde aesthetics between 1860 and 1940 consequently relied on programs of not on autonomy of the arts, but of heteronomy, looking for something that is superior to the autonomy and the freedom of the arts. It could be party politics, it could be esotericism, it could be a higher force, it could be religious, but it could also be primitivism. That's why primitivism is so important for modernity in this quest for something stronger than art or the modern system of the arts. Geology and archaeology had opened up an abyss of time beyond the short biblical chronology of thousands and ten thousands or even hundred thousands of years, running across prehistory and the colonies, across biological time with Darwin, and conjectural historical genealogies. And nobody knew how to deal with that abyss of time, or nobody knew exactly what to do with this abyss of time that had opened up after 1860. This new strange time, this allochronie, this allochronism of a primitive antiquity, inherited, obviously, the old antiquities of antiquarianism and revived the worldwide pagan extensions. And they were called the primitives, or primitive religion, primitive society, primitive culture. Thus, the search for primitive origins had to look for a universal ecumene beyond and superior to the exclusivity of Eurocentric history. So there's this irony built into Eurocentrism in the 19th century that it has a boomerang effect and a reversal, because the universal mankind, of course, was not Eurocentric, and Eurocentric people knew that. So on the one hand, between the long 19th century, you find this imperialist union of knowledge and power and understanding to be exclusive. And there are famous sentences by Max Weber, nur in Europa, only in Europe, as they wrote from Hegel and to Max Weber. But the exclusivity of progress excludes the excluders from the majority of mankind. It's self-exclusion too, of human history and of humanity itself. Thus, the scientific search for biological and cultural origins and for a non-racist psychic unity had to turn primitivist. And first in science, and then in art, and in art history too. Looking for its universal origins. That's, I'm not going to show it, but if you remember Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, it's very, very late, it's 1907 or something, and it's after, let's say, 60, 70 years of people thinking theoretically that it has to happen. So it took a very long time to create an art that looked convincingly primitive in Europe. And basically that's why how we should look at Picasso and all the others, that it was a really a desperate effort to do something primitive after knowing that it had to happen. Going to the circus, going to the zoo, going to the Völker Show. Well, what are we going to do? One generation thought, yeah. So, the exclusivity excludes the excluders, which of course reminds of Marx. It's a Marx quote, like expropriating the expropriators. And the projects of anti-Eurocentric canonists were developed in the sciences and the arts. And on a more practical level, and that's the interesting thing, in the contact zones of ambiguously colonialist and anti-colonialist or racist and anti-racist practices. Especially in dance music, as we know, so with jazz, modern jazz, but also in modern esotericism, as I said, with people traveling to India, theosophy, and very much related, for example, also to Mahatma Gandhi. In political movements and religious fundamentalisms. And these four things are not so far apart. So dance music and, for example, religious fundamentalism is very intimately related, as we know from Rastafari movement, but we can also show this in 1900. So there's an intimate link between the dance, Black Atlantic, and new religious fundamentalism, and people going from the one side to the other. So this is the exciting world of the long 19th century, of the old avant-garde until 1940. And now we come to the pregnant oyster where we are now. The world of the avant-garde was destroyed in two world wars. And after World War II, modernism was canonized by new academic elites, stressing not the strife and the political strife and this chaos, but the consistency and the accomplishment of modernist artistic autonomy. So they read the old avant-garde not as looking for a new canon of heteronomy, but as the people who had accomplished autonomy in the arts. That's the reading of modernism in the 1950s and in a sense ever since. Modernism was turned into its own antiquity, or as we say in Germany, klassische Moderne, classical modernism, and used as a mythical charter for the present, which forced artists to work on the basis of bootstrapping from the new modernist canon. Not bootstrapping from what the avant-garde had worked off, in primitivism, for example, but working on from modernist artworks. It also meant the division of the Cold War world into the two dominant blocs, plus a third world defined the former colonies as proxy territories with proxy wars, Stellvertreterterritorien, Stellvertreterkriege. And as objects and subjects of progress, political liberation, and educational development. Primitivism, of course, had to fade. It took some 30 years, but it faded with decolonization. But also the antiquity of modernism in that sense was somehow lost or frozen. Also, as academic, I'm being an academic, of course, we have to face the fact that after World War II saw a worldwide expansion of educational institutions. And most of these institutions combined the Eurocentric canon of the modern system of the arts with a new modernist canon, ignoring this whole modernist boomerang effect. The Cold War world was, of course, deeply divided between Marxist and anti-Marxist movements, but it was also obsessed with figures of immanence, of political and aesthetic doctrines of containment, with academic self-commentary and with commentaries on modernist philosophies of history. That means in Germany, in France, but also in America. It was deeply self-referential and the famous gestures of French and, of course, German philosophers too, il n'y a pas dehors de, there's no outside of the text, of discourse. These are figures of immanence, deeply related somehow to the Cold War, structuralism too. The ruptures within the architecture of the canon during the Cold War took thus the form of dealing with the heritage, with this famous word post-modernist, post-structuralist, and finally post-colonial criticism. But on the whole, these ruptures didn't succeed to shatter this educational link between 1800s Eurocentrism and 1950s modernism. And as I used to say, not in Berlin. So, after 1989, of course, a new situation develops. The blocks somehow not dissolve and were turned into something else. And we were looking into these three mirrors. The postcolonial mirror of the age of imperialism, of high imperialism, into the mirror of European globalization since 1492, and the new universalized worldwide history, intercontinental entanglements, which is very popular in the history departments now, worldwide diffusions and migrations. So in a sense, this moment was too easy. Maybe it's too difficult also for us to comprehend, because we were falling back or thrown back onto projects that had already existed, the old project or the old projections of world literature, world art, world music, and world philosophy that had been put forth in 1800 or 1900. The recognition of multiple modernities, of global modernisms, certainly is a first step to revise the canon and the streamlined or frozen modernism of the 1950s. But to aid this recognition, it will be necessary to retrace the multiple antiquities of modernity. The non-linear history of Eurocentrism, which is not linear, it's not going back to the Greeks, and not even going back to the Middle Ages or something. It's very recent, and the alternating options of Euro and non-Eurocentric canons, even in our universities. So that brings me to a very slow and quick conclusion, because I have to stop here. The only lesson I can draw from this historical tour de force is the modifications of the canon of these 400 years were modifications of the antiquity enshrined or unleashed in the canon, of what became a repertoire and where to look for a new repertoire in the archive. And of course, being here in this pregnant oyster, you could say our antiquity that we relate to strongest is maybe 1950s modernism, maybe not. But it means to change the canon. It will not be enough to refer to the past as a genealogical charter for the present or to look for a past that fits the present at lock and key. That's what everybody has been doing, but it leads basically nowhere. To revolutionize the canon, you have to revise the category of what counts as antiquity, and maybe in a sense to acknowledge, first of all, this palimpsest of antiquities that is in layers of our antiquity, the modernism of the 1950s and 60s, the primitivism of modernist avant-gardes, the antiquity of antiquarianism that is enshrined and unleashed in this primitive antiquity of the modernists, and of course going back to antiquity and the antiquity of the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Erhard. I have to already deviate from the announced script now because I really have to make sure that we don't run over time already at such an early point. So no common conversation, I'm afraid. And I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Mark Wigley. I'm very glad that you are here. Mark Wigley is a professor of architecture and dean emeritus at Columbia Graduate School of Architecture, curator, together with Beatrice Colomina, of the upcoming Istanbul Design Biennale, among others, and author of influential, important books for, I suppose, many of us, particularly Derrida's Haunt and the book on the designer's dresses and white surfaces of architectures that will also be the topic of the reflection on the limits and limitlessness in second half of the 20th century and up till now. Mark, please welcome Mark Wigley with me.